The goal is to essentially get your website listed on someone else's website that is hopefully more authoritative than yours.
Welcome to the Imperfectly Empowered Podcast with DIY healthy lifestyle blogger, Anna Fulmer. Empowering you to transform your life one imperfect day at a time.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Imperfectly Empowered Podcast. I am your host, Anna Fulmer. Today we have Jake Dazio on the show. Jake is an internationally renowned website SEO and traffic expert. He has worked with hundreds of industry leading companies to fuel online revenue growth. He is the owner of digital marketing firm Watson Digital, and he is here to teach us how to play the Google game and increase our website traffic, optimize our SEO strategy. Here to help us out is expert Jake Dazio.
Hi.
Hi, Jake.
Oh, how are you?
Good. Okay. How do you say your last name? Because on the phonetic spelling, it just said D-A. And I was like, is that Da or Day? I wasn't sure.
Oh, Dazio. Yeah. Or Dazio.
Oh, okay. Dazio.
Yeah, people say it both ways.
Oh, I see.
It doesn't offend me either way. It's originally it was Dazio. And I think starting with like me and my siblings, my mom had it changed legally. So I think technically she's still Dazio.
Interesting.
None of us are. For some reason, I guess my dad never used it anyway, so she's like, why complicate things? I don't know.
Well, at least we've just made your name way more interesting. So it's Dazio. Right. That makes sense why you said D-A. Yes. All right. Yeah. Well, welcome, Jake Dazio.
Thank you.
To the show. Yeah. I was excited when I saw your expertise because SEO, I mean, if you don't know my background, the bottom line is I was in medicine for 15 years. I was an ER nurse practitioner. Worked in the ER for 10. And then when I got into the blogging world, there was this whole new language that came with that space, including things like SEO being a phrase I heard all of the time, or like widgets. I was like, what the heck is a widget? That is not a real thing. That's from Star Wars. People, stop making these words up. But SEO was a phrase I heard over and over again. Fast forward 3 years, and it is arguably maybe the most essential piece of a website. Once you get the foundation set up, it's kind of the most important next step. So we're going to dive into more of your expertise in a little bit and talk about your digital marketing firm and who you serve, basically who needs you, which is basically anyone who owns a website. I'm going to throw that out there. But let's press rewind for a minute and chat a little bit about where you started, because you have some interesting, you moved to Hawaii in high school, like 5,000 miles, no big deal.
Yeah, which is wild to think about. I remember, so I grew up in Rhode Island.
Okay.
You may have heard of it, you may not have. If you've ever watched Family Guy, you probably have. Otherwise, probably not. Very small blip on the map. And when I found out I was moving to Hawaii, of course, I told everybody, I told all my friends, and some of the questions I fielded were, you know, oh, Hawaii, do they have internet there? Do they, you know, my Nana asked if there were going to be, you know, Americans there. You know, my Nana, bless her soul, in her 90s, she grew up in a time when Hawaii wasn't necessarily like this big blossoming state. And so a lot of questions because no one knew. And for the, I don't know, month before I was moving there, that everyone knew I was going to move there, I became the most popular person in the entire high school simply because everyone is like, no one leaves here. Coventry, Rhode Island, a great place, but a small place. So, you know, not a lot of people leave. And if they do leave, they go to other places on the East Coast generally. And so the topic of Hawaii was exciting for everybody. And I'm very thankful that I did it and that my parents, you know, chose to go there. Because it really opened up a whole new worldview and a whole new world because, of course, the culture in Hawaii is so different than the culture anywhere on the East Coast.
Yeah. Now, I'm really curious. So what you probably don't know is we're actually adopting. So we have 3 children biologically and we're adopting our 4th. And it will be a little boy from the Pacific island of Samoa. So, I've been to Hawaii. And for those that don't know, they're certainly very different, but there's a very consistent like Polynesian feel to both islands. And a lot, from what I understand, a lot of Samoans actually move to Hawaii, whether it's to go to school or for a variety of reasons. So there's a lot of ties. So I'm curious to hear in your experience, what are some of the Polynesian or culture aspects to Hawaii that you noticed that, you know, we could potentially incorporate into our own home?
Yeah, I think Polynesian culture and Hawaiian culture, which to, you know, what you said, do have some overlap, are both incredible. Mm. What I find to be my favorite parts is mostly the food, food culture there.
Oh my gosh, you guys, the food in Hawaii is so fresh. That's what got me. Like when my husband and I went, we were like, everything is just so fresh. We don't know how to say it. It just didn't taste, nothing tastes boxed. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to explain.
Yeah, especially when you're talking about, you know, some of the local fish that you can get. I mean, I had my best friend used to work for a company that was based on the fishing docks. He worked for a pirate ship, like cruise company, but he would always get fresh fish and then bring it over to my place. And so we'd be eating, you know, seared ahi that was caught earlier that morning. It was incredible. The fruit, you know, when it's mango season, you can literally walk down the road and there's just mangoes sitting on a wall that someone had picked. And, you know, they have a mango tree. They're not going to eat 30 mangoes in, you know, the 3 weeks that they have before they go bad. So they just leave some mangoes out. And I would walk home from, you know, when I was going to University of Hawaii, I'd walk home sometimes and there'd be mangoes right there. I'd take some home and they were just incredible. So the food culture is spectacular.
That's amazing. We'll never forget. We talk about this all the time. We went to three islands when we were in Hawaii. I actually spoke at a conference initially in Honolulu, so on Oahu. And then we went to Molokai, which was an experience. And then we went to Kauai. But when we were on Molokai, we'll never forget the one morning they didn't serve fresh papaya. And we're like, oh, that's fine, no big deal. And she said, well, they're just not ripe yet on the tree. We were like, oh my word, they're literally going to their backyard and picking these papayas off the tree to serve them in the morning, which is why they were so amazing. So that is really, what about recipes? Are there recipes that you would say are probably like more Polynesian that I can be making in my home?
You know, that's a great question. And I'm not necessarily an expert on Polynesian versus Hawaiian versus some of the other influences in Hawaii. Yeah. Something that's interesting that I found is that Hawaii is very much a mixing pot in terms of foods and things of that nature. There's heavy Japanese influence, heavy, you know, American influence, of course, heavy Hawaiian, Polynesian. So there's a lot of influence from a lot of different cultures. And so I couldn't speak on specific Polynesian recipes. So you may have to look those up yourself.
Yeah.
But I do know that, you know, some of the main things you can get in Hawaii from a lot of different cultures are all kind of mainstays. Even in my current day, you know, my wife is from Oregon, which is where I'm based now. And so just from us getting together, I've introduced her to so many foods that I brought over from living in Hawaii that are now almost weekly recipes that we make at home, and they're all fantastic.
Okay, let me hear some of those recipes.
So one that kind of walks the line of like healthy to unhealthy would be chicken katsu. It's about as simple as it gets. You take, you know, a chicken breast, and you make it really, really thin, you know, hammer it really thin.
Okay.
And then you put panko crust on it, and then you, you know, throw it in some oil. And so it's essentially a fried chicken, but I believe, I may be wrong here, that chicken katsu is based on pork katsu, which is a mainstay in Japanese culture. And it is so delicious. You put a little bit of whatever sauce you want, and I'm blanking on the name, katsu sauce, literally katsu sauce, which is, I guess the closest sauce that you may recognize that's kind of similar to it is like a barbecue sauce, but it's got a much different flavor to it.
Okay.
And so that's delicious.
And that's after you cook it in the oil. And what kind of oil are you typically using for this?
Hey, parents.
Yeah, you.
Are you looking for a podcast your kids will really love?
Well, we made one just for you.
And for us.
As genuine, all-natural kids ourselves, we know what makes a fun and interesting podcast.
So we decided to make it ourselves. Every show is packed with interviews, stories, and on-the-ground reporting.
We have interviewed everyone from scientists to Grammy Award-winning musicians to NFL quarterbacks.
Listen to Wild Interest wherever you get your podcasts.
Any type of fry oil that you like. We've even made it in an air fryer before and it came out delicious. So it just depends on how healthy you want to be with it. You can just throw it in some, you know, vegetable canola oil. You could air fry it, but it comes out so good and so crispy.
So it's just breadcrumbs. So you're saying it's just breadcrumbs over a chicken breast.
Yes. Yeah. Huh. A very thin pounded chicken breast and then usually panko breadcrumbs. I would recommend getting, you know, a Japanese brand of panko breadcrumbs because they're actually significantly better than, let's say, like a standard store brand panko crumb.
Interesting.
That you might use for other recipes. But it's so good and so simple.
How long in the air fryer?
Oh, gosh. That's a better question for my wife since she's the one who cooks it most often. Yeah, exactly. But it's not very long. It's pretty quick.
So what other recipes? So we've got chicken. He was not prepared for this, people.
No, not at all. I'm racking my brain on what I love the most. I mean, any type of poke. Anyone who's on the West Coast.
Oh, yeah. Tell us what poke is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I had never heard of it until I was in Hawaii.
Yeah.
I was like, what is this?
Poke is essentially just like cubes of raw fish with different sauces or flavoring on it. And so what a lot of people would think, you know, oh, raw fish, cubes of raw fish, that sounds...
It looked unique, very fishy, pun intended.
Unique, interesting. Unless you've eaten sushi, you probably haven't eaten raw fish at all. And if you haven't been to Hawaii, you probably haven't experienced true poke, because I know that poke has now expanded out to the West Coast, and I see it in Oregon all the time. It's very popular in California. But a lot of those recipes are made specifically for the palates of people who are on the West Coast. And when you go to Hawaii, you get more of a authentic experience. And so you can go to the local supermarkets. You know, Tamora's and Foodland even have pretty decent poke, which is kind of crazy because you don't see that in the supermarkets when you're on the mainland U.S. But yeah, it's just cubes of raw fish, typically ahi. That's my favorite kind, but you can get, you know, taco, which is octopus. You can get, some will make salmon, but I prefer ahi all the way. And I really love spicy ahi, which is essentially like a spicy mayo and some other seasonings just mixed up with this raw fish tossed in a big bowl. And it's so good. You usually would put it over rice, maybe put a little furikake seasoning on it. Which
Why not just cook the fish? I have to ask. I love fish. I can't do the raw fish.
You could cook ahi, but in poke, for, you know, I don't know the history of it, but it's raw fish. I mean, and honestly, when
this
it comes
sounds,
to like,
here's shot, here's what happened with poke. Correct me if I'm wrong, Hawaiian women. This is what it sounds like to me. Basically, a bunch of women said, "I'm sick of spending my entire life around the stove. I'm not even gonna bother cooking this fish. I'm gonna chop it up, throw it in a bunch of sauce. You can eat it," and that's how it came about.
You know,
sounds
it could
like
be
an effective use of time.
It could be, but honestly, even when you cook ahi, like a just a very quickly seared ahi with some, you know, citrus on top,
that sounds
was
amazing.
One of the best tastes. If it's fresh, it's one of the best tasting things I've ever had in my life. It's so good.
I love fish. That's what was so like kind of confusing and frustrating about, you said poke, right? It's how you pronounce it to me. When I saw it, I was like, this has the possibility of being so delicious, but I can't do the raw.
You got to get over that. My wife is the same way. She's very much a, you know, texture will get her when it comes to eating. And so she's the exact same way. Raw fish just doesn't jive, even though it tastes so good. Yeah. She just can't do it with the texture.
I actually think it would be one of those scenarios if I didn't realize it was raw and it was like smothered enough that I couldn't see it, I could probably get over it. Like, just tell me it's cooked and I could probably...
Yeah, well, if you can trick yourself, go get some spicy ahi if you like spicy food enough. And it doesn't look like it's raw fish because it is smothered in that, you know, spicy mayo, essentially.
Yeah.
You might be able to trick yourself.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I did. I had an acai bowl for the very first time when I was in Hawaii. And that was the only problem with that is it ruined any other acai bowl for the rest of my life because my first one was in Hawaii. So it was perfection. And then I came back here and I was like,
Yeah, and I'll give a shout out to Haleiwa Bowl up in Haleiwa, Hawaii on Oahu. Okay. They make one of the best acai bowls I've ever had in my life, and they are so good. And so if I could start my morning with one every morning, I absolutely would. There's no doubt that would be
breakfast. Where is that one at? Is it in Honolulu?
No, so that's in Haleiwa, okay. Which is up on the north shore of Hawaii. Oh, okay. So if you go to Oahu and you don't leave Honolulu, I think you miss out on a huge experience.
I believe that, yeah.
It's so catered to the tourist. I mean, tourism is the biggest industry in Hawaii. Yeah. And so when you're down there and you only spend your time in, let's say, Waikiki and general Honolulu area, you're missing so many things. Back to what you were talking about earlier, the Polynesian culture. Up on the North Shore, there's also the Polynesian Cultural Center, and that is such a fun place to visit.
Oh, on Oahu?
I would recommend you go. Yeah, I would recommend you go there if you're looking
for
more Polynesian culture in general, to learn more about it and to experience it in a more, you know, tourism setting. The Cultural Center up there is awesome, and the North Shore has the best beaches on Oahu, in my opinion, and in many like bloggers' opinions. It's fun to go around and see the different aspects of Hawaii that you can. And if you stick in Waikiki, you're going to miss out on so much.
Yeah, Waikiki was very pretty, but I can see what you're saying. It is very touristy. It's definitely not the more authentic Hawaiian. Like Molokai felt very much like we were just part of the community.
Island hopping isn't that prohibitive. You can island hop you know, maybe $100 a ticket. I don't know what it's like now, given, you know, the airfare prices increasing, but generally it's like $100 a ticket. You can pop over to Maui, Kauai, any of those islands and have a totally different experience. I know that on Big Island, for example, you can ski down a mountain and then end up on a beach, essentially. Like, and not exactly, but it's like, you know, you have all these different, I guess, biospheres, I don't remember the exact word, but you have all these different places you can visit with all different experiences.
Yeah, it was drastic, the difference even just between, I was only in Honolulu, so to your point, I certainly did not experience all of Oahu, but the difference between Honolulu, Kauai, and Molokai even was significant, the feel of each. My dream is to go back to Maui. I think Maui would probably be my happy middle ground. And from the people I know that live on Hawaii, they kind of say that's probably true. It's like maybe the best mix of a little bit more tourism, but also a lot of the like outdoorsy adventure.
Yeah, it's a great island. My best friend is from Maui. That's where he grew up. And it is a lot of fun to go there. And I agree with you. Yeah. I think it's a good middle ground between, let's say, the very tourism heavy island of Oahu and the much more rural island of Kauai. I could see Maui being a good in between.
Yeah. Well, there we go. I'm buying my ticket. Does not take much for me to learn more about Hawaii. It makes me warmer just thinking about it.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because, you know, I was living in most people's dream vacation, which is such an interesting experience too, I would say.
Yeah. You know, talking about Hawaii, you have started 4 businesses now. And several of those business startups initially happened, if I understand, in Hawaii when you were living there. So tell me a little bit about how those experiences kind of all culminated in where you are now with your own digital marketing firm. Tell me how that sort of brought you to where you're at today. And any mistakes you made in the process, lessons learned, any like big moments that stick out?
Yeah, well, I'll start that off with the digital marketing agency being the only business that I started that is profitable. And, you know, it wasn't a failure, an entrepreneurial failure, which I think all failures are lessons learned. So I'm happy to share the failures.
Absolutely.
But the first like business I started, where, you know, I formed an LLC and did all of those steps, was an artist management company. So I was in fraternity in college at University of Hawaii called Teak. And two of my fraternity brothers and good friends of mine were DJs. So they would DJ our local parties. When we do club events, they DJ those. And they were taking it seriously enough that they were putting out, you know, music on SoundCloud and things of those natures. And so I was spending a lot of time with them. I was the social chair at the time. So I was also the one kind of managing the relationship with these clubs and hosting these parties and then booking the talent for them. And so I was like, this seems like a natural fit for me to kind of manage your careers up to this point and help you get more gigs. And so in that way, we had a lot of successes. We threw a club party where G-Eazy came to the club party. We threw a Too Short concert, and he was a blast. And I got them to open up for some really big EDM artists like Cascade and Arlo Grime and Toki Monster and some names.
Wait, is EDM the type of a type of music?
Yeah, so it's electronic dance music is what that stands for. So
I would not have known that. Okay,
that type of that type of thing. Maybe one of the most widely known artists in that space would be like, I don't know if you know, like Steve Aoki or someone like that. They're pretty widely known. But Cascade and Arl Grime are two very, very big players in that space. Huge, huge recording artists. Mm. And so opening for them was really cool. Big opportunity. And that was all done in Hawaii. And so I tried to take that business to the mainland. It went pretty well. You know, we made a little bit of money. It wasn't crazy. But mostly it was just for the fun of it. And then when I went to the mainland, I was like, all right, let's see if I can continue to push the bill on this.
And tell people, when you say you went to the mainland, tell people what you mean.
Yeah. So you have, Hawaii is a state, you know, we don't need to get into the history of that and, you know, whether I agree with it or not. But when you're on Hawaii, you call the mainland U.S. the mainland. So basically the 48 states that you can drive to from where you're sitting now, if you're in a U.S. state that isn't Alaska or Hawaii.
Yeah.
That would be your mainland states.
It's like if you live in Great Britain and you call Europe the continent. It's like I've gone to the continent.
Yeah, I would say same.
Similar thing. Concept, yeah.
Similar concept. So yeah, when I came up to Oregon after college, I was like, oh, maybe I can continue to do this artist management thing and really push that. You know, both of my friends were still producing their own music, still doing events, still loving it. And really where it all came to head, where I decided it wasn't going to be the rest of my life and I didn't want to continue doing it, is one of my two friends had gone to Europe and met someone who is a producer and then put a lot of music out, you know, this person in Europe. And so he came back from that Europe trip like, hey, we should co-produce a song with this guy. It can be my first true single, you know, my first true song. And that's when we got to see the kind of, I would say, ugly underbelly of the music industry. Because the person he met in Europe, fantastic guy, put us in touch with someone else who had a connect to Sony Music. And so we were all excited. We were like, all right, we're going to work with this producer. We're going to get a contract with Sony and we're going to put out our first song. And it's going to be awesome. So, you know, we put up some money, most of it my own. And this is how I ended up losing money on that business overall. Because while we had made some good money in Hawaii, it wasn't enough to cover this big song. So I put up some of my own money. He put up a little bit of his. And we have this song produced. What we came to find out is that really what this producer we put in touch with, who has a connection to Sony, really what he wanted to do was take a track that he had already produced, sell it to us, and then sell it to Sony with our name attached to it. And because we had already coughed up the money, we're like, all right, we'll see this through, but it doesn't feel right, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But if we back out, we're not going to get our money back. So let's just see this through and see what happens. What ended up happening is that song had vocals on it from a singer who's based in the U.S. and she's even been on a Cascade song. So she, you know, pretty big singer in the U.S. and they technically had the rights to her lyrics and to her voice. She had recorded it so many years before that it wasn't something she wanted put out. And so now we're stuck where we have this song that has an artist who we can technically use, but really doesn't want us to use those lyrics because they're so dated. She had no idea she was attached to this song because she had recorded them so many years ago. And when, you know, the contract was submitted to us from Sony, there were some really big things in there that we weren't okay with. And so on the first pushback of, hey, can we ask about this, this, and this? The guy who we'd been put in touch with essentially said, you don't question Sony, the deal's off.
Mm.
And so where it ended is we did end up putting out this song. You can find it on Spotify. But it wasn't in the way we wanted it. We lost a bunch of money on it. It was through some other smaller non-Sony entity that really wasn't that impressive. Ended up on a phone call with the singer, and you know, I'm sure she doesn't like us very much because of it, even though you know, it ended up being, we were very out of control when it came to that. And so after seeing all that gross underbelly and how this basically ghost-produced song negatively impacted us, negatively impacted the singer, and didn't do anything positive, I was like, you know what? This is not the industry for me. Right. So that was business number one. And it was
that was just business number one. Right. Yeah.
Quite
yeah.
Experience.
So that transitioned into what were two and three. So you went from music production to.
Yeah.
We're still a long way away from digital marketing. So keep going.
Yeah. So then at the time I was living in Oregon, I was interning with the Portland Trailblazers, which was a really cool experience. You know, I really love sports, always have, probably always will.
This is going to show my ignorance. Is that a soccer team? Trailblazers, I'm not familiar.
Portland Trailblazers are the NBA basketball team of Portland.
Oh, basketball. Okay.
So they're basketball. Yep. And so super cool.
I just literally threw out a sport. I was like, Trailblazers, I'm going to go with soccer.
Yeah.
It has a ball. I was close. Okay. So basketball. All right.
So, yeah,
so we went from music to basketball. All right.
Music to basketball. Yeah. I took my experience everywhere just to kind of see what fit. And basically what happened is I was like, you know, I don't want to go into ticket sales. I don't think that's for me. And so I ended up then going to a company called Logical Position, which is a really big digital marketing firm based in Oregon. They're large enough that, you know, you see them listed as like a chosen partner on a lot of big websites, like Google's website, even on Microsoft's website, on you know, a lot of these other big companies. So they've done a lot of big things. And so I end up there, and that's where I really got interested in digital marketing and e-commerce. I had gone to business school. I knew that's what I wanted to do. I just didn't know in what field exactly. And so that's where I started my second business, because a lot of people who were in my sphere at that company, you know, big company, I think probably over 500 employees by now, some other people had done e-commerce, and I thought of it as a really good opportunity to really see what, I guess, what the average entrepreneur goes through, or at least the average client goes through. I was in sales when I was there, and so I was talking with owners of large e-commerce stores and learning from them, but I wanted to be able to experience what they've experienced to have better conversation with them. It's really the motivation. So I found a very niche market, and it was selling like earbuds, essentially. So like those cheap ones you get on like an airplane, or you get handed if you're at an event. If you get a free pair of earbuds, it was that type of thing. And that was really cool. I did that for about a year. I think I basically broke even. I had, and I got to experience sourcing product, finding a U.S. warehouse to send that product to from the manufacturer. And then that place that I warehouse was also the fulfillment center. And so then, you know, marketing that business using Google Ads, using SEO, building a website on WordPress, and doing the whole thing to really understand what a e-commerce business owner goes through from end to end, getting on Amazon, getting all those things done. And that was really, really cool. But once I sold out of the product that I had, I was basically at break even. And so my decision was, do I want to keep doing this and push it and order more product, take on that, you know, that risk of having a few grand in product that I then need to sell? Or do I want to focus on something else? And so I decided to focus on something else, but that was business number two.
And it's interesting because it's what I love about these stories is that you're slowly winding your way to the profitable one. Oh, that was business number two.
Yeah.
So what was three? I missed.
So three is less of a business. It's not an official LLC. Through having that company, basically I tried to sell that e-commerce company.
Okay.
So I found a group on Facebook called Small Business Owners United, which is now, you know, an 80 to 90,000 member group on Facebook. And when I posted there, the managing partner of that group, Sergio, he saw that post and he saw the potential in me, essentially, to say, it looks like you know what you're doing. You know, I'm only 28 now, so I was in my early 20s at the time. And so he saw the potential there and basically contacted me and said, hey, do you want to be more involved with our group? Basically, we're trying to monetize this group that is full of great information and full of, you know, these 90,000 members. So do you want to kind of come on board and help with that? And I'm still part of that group, basically providing different programs and different material to try to kind of monetize some of the small business owners who spend their time in that group. And so it's not necessarily my own business. It's not something that takes up a ton of time, but I am still involved in it.
And it's helpful. It's helpful when you're in digital marketing to understand how to really leverage a social platform, especially one like Facebook that has a massive, especially the community potential on Facebook, I think is the strength there, is the groups.
Yeah, and I've seen that transition over the years. I help a client of mine manage a large Discord server that's a pay-to-enter type Discord server. So I've seen a lot of that community shift, not from Facebook completely, but expand maybe into Discord servers and Reddit and places of that nature too.
I'm not familiar with Discord. I can't say I've heard of Discord.
Yeah, so their quick backstory, only because I've heard their interview on some podcasts, is their whole idea is that they are a place for people to hang out. You create a server, and then you have channels that you can spend time in that are text-based or voice-based. So a lot of people use it for gaming. You know, I have a server for me and my friends, and we all hop in there when we're going to play video games together and use the voice chat feature. Mm-hmm. So it's got a lot of power depending on how you want to leverage it. I think a lot
of people use it for study groups. So it's almost like radio a little bit that I'm hearing. You can like it's audio or audio visual.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I'd imagine like if you've spent any time with like Slack, for example, it's a little bit like a Slack, but for more personal use.
Okay.
And there's servers for every topic. So, you know, if you were interested in gaming or a specific game, or in some cases a specific strategy in a specific game, there's likely a server there for you. If you're interested in having a study group, if you're interested in fitness, whatever you're interested in, there's likely a server you can then join. And so the way that I use it for this client is this client puts out great information on the topic of investment and options trading, puts out a ton of educational stuff. And then the paid portion is you pay to be part of a smaller group that is all interested in that topic and is learning from each other and that type of thing.
So, there's so much out there, which is why you need Jake's help. I'm listening to you and I'm like, I have not even heard of half of these things, and I'm in this space. So that tells you something. Well, we're going to take a really quick break, but when we come back, tune in for a speed round of This or That with Jake. And then we are going to hear more of his expert advice on improving your website SEO to build and monetize your business right when we come back.
You have tried it all. Worried you will never lose the extra weight or reclaim the energy you once enjoyed? Want to achieve fat loss without spending hours in a gym or eliminating entire food groups from your diet? Well, now you can. In the virtual Faster Way to Fat Loss with Anna, my 6-week fitness and nutrition program, you will learn how to pair effective 30-minute workouts with all-natural, evidence-based nutritional strategies to leverage what you eat and when you eat to reset your metabolism and burn fat fast, even that stubborn belly fat. I am a dual-certified nurse practitioner passionate about teaching sustainable strategies to promote fat loss and prevent disease. I have cheered on thousands of clients who have done just that with the Faster Way program. In my 6-week program, the average client currently sheds 7 inches of body fat. 93% report more energy, and 89% state that their mental health has improved. 100% of clients report they feel this program is sustainable. Curious to try the program but not sure if the strategies will work for you? Try the Faster Way strategies for free. Head to www.hammersandhugs.com and sign up for my free 7-day fat loss accelerator course today and start your own transformation story.
All right, we are back here with Jake. We're going to play a quick round of This or That. So let's start with one that I did not have on here. Pop or EDM?
It depends on the mood, but I'm going to go EDM 90% of the time.
Okay, and favorite?
Favorite artist,
band,
right now, whatever. Always has been Odessa.
There you go. Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Cream or black?
Bulletproof, actually.
Oh, okay. Speaking of coffee, actually, Hawaii has some very good coffee as well. That was interesting. Kona coffee, I'd never heard of it. It's like huge over there.
If you can get 100% Kona coffee, it is delicious.
You will also pay for it, but it is... well worth it as a coffee lover myself. Burger or hot dog?
Burger.
Poke or acai bowl? Acai bowl. Ooh,
that's a tough one. Depends on the time of day, but I'm going to go poke.
Okay. Kindle or old-fashioned book?
Big Kindle guy.
Facebook or Instagram?
Instagram.
YouTube or Netflix?
Netflix.
Water skiing or scuba diving?
Wow, both are a ton of fun. I'm going to go scuba diving.
And Kauai or Maui to visit?
Hi, Denise Hamilton Mace here, host of the Low No Drinker podcast, your place to go to meet the people and brands leading the low and no alcohol revolution. Every week, I speak to brand founders like Carl Anthony Brown from CrossFit Non-Alcoholic Spirits and ex-master chef finalist Billy Wright from Descent 10% Gin. Industry experts like Hamish Renton in our chat about how the fat jabs will impact low and no drinkers. And I help you answer questions like, what the heck is the difference between non-alcoholic and alcohol-free anyways? This podcast is for you if you're looking for a fun and informative way to explore a life less intoxicated with no judgment or expectation. Check out the link in the description or find me at lownodrinkermagazine.com.
I'm going to go Maui because that's where my buddy's family is. And so we can stay fair. His family is very large property.
Hi, buddy.
And have an absolute blast.
We need to be friends too, apparently. I'm coming to visit you. I actually, some of my really close friends just moved to Kauai. So I'm like, I'm finding people that I know. And I'm like, can you move to Hawaii? Like, we just need more people in Hawaii. Yeah, that's how we need to do it. Well, let's talk SEO. You are an expert in so many different areas when it comes to digital marketing, but we're going to niche down a little bit and dive into an area that is probably more familiar for a lot of people. So the bottom line is, anyone who is listening and watching this, if you have a website for anything, or you have a dream of creating a website for anything, then you need to listen in, because this is ultimately kind of like the cream of the crop, if you will, to get your website functioning well. But start from the very beginning. What is SEO and why is it important for people who don't understand?
Sure. So the most layman's way to put it, I would say, is when you go to Google or any other search engine that you use and you search something, the listings that propagate, that answer your search, are organic listings and paid listings. But to show those listings, you need to invest in SEO. SEO is just the practice of helping websites improve where they show when someone searches for something related to their website.
So SEO is search engine optimization. And the goal of every website, or like in my case, a blog, obviously it's a website as well. So like blogging, any of you, this would fall into the same category. But basically, whatever it is that you are a quote unquote expert on, you want to show up in Google when somebody searches. So if somebody would search intermittent fasting, I would love to show up somewhere on that first page. Or if they search, so for example, I do actually show up, at least I was number one. If you search vintage dough bowls, of all things, never even tried to SEO that post, and somehow I ended up ranking for it. So I'm like number one or two if you search vintage dough bowls, decorate dough bowl, antique dough bowls. Same is also true. My blog comes up in the top page. I'm one or two for Victorian basement. Again, of all things, did not try that. So when he's talking about like a search engine, it's basically when you type into Google what you are typing, there's a very specific strategy to help people with a website show up on that first page so that you will ultimately click on it. Because whether you are a completely digital business or you just have a website that points people to an actual service or product, you want to show up. So tell us, what are the top things that any website owner, this can be maybe a little bit more broad before we dive more specifically, but what are the top things that website owners should be doing for SEO, or maybe are not doing and should be?
Sure. I'll give you three things that pretty much any website owner can do. It's pretty easy. And the way to think about it is, for most people, Google is the one they would like to have the best SEO on. And if you're optimizing for Google, it's highly likely that that's going to positively impact your Microsoft and other search engines placement. So when you think about it from that angle, what does Google want to see to say that your page is valuable to the person searching? Their whole goal in their business is to have people use their search engine. Mm-hmm. That's where they drive a lot of their revenue. And so to keep you and I as Google users, they have to give the most relevant thing to what you're looking for when you either type something in or you voice search with it. So to show Google that you are the most relevant thing for any keyword that you're targeting, there's a few things you want to do. So number one thing that I think a lot of business owners may not realize that they need or really think too much about is their Google My Business listing. And for those who don't really know what that is, Google My Business is essentially your business's profile on Google. You can put pictures there. You can put business information there. You can post there. You can collect reviews there. And oftentimes when you search for a very specific business, you'll see their organic listing and right next to it, their Google My Business listing. This is also how you would get on Google Maps. So this is especially important if you have a location.
Like brick and mortar. Yeah. Now, what about a blogger who's not got a brick and mortar? Would they also need to do this?
While it would be, maybe it would be less important, but I still think it's valuable to have because it's one more place to send trust signals to Google. If you're collecting reviews there, if you're making posts there, if you're putting pictures up of your business. And if you're a blogger, that might be the graphic that you post on your blog anyways. That might be what you post to your profile on Google My Business. I think it's important to anybody.
So Google My Business. And is that the actual, is it googlemybusiness.com?
I want to say it might be business.google.com. But if you Google My Business, it's the first thing that's going to pop up.
How many times can we say Google in 10 seconds? Okay, so this is what you need to do. Google, like type it into the Google search engine, Google My Business, and then you need to add your business, whatever it may be, into the Google My Business platform. Okay.
Yes.
I love that. I have never heard of that.
Yeah. That one is a good low-hanging fruit that is designed for anyone to be able to do.
Is there upkeep with that? Like, I'm instantly thinking, like, LinkedIn, I get 5 million messages. I took myself off of it. I was like, what is this? is that what's going to happen with Google My Business?
No, not really. Part of like the SEO service I offer is to optimize it over time. And really what that comes down to is keeping it fresh, essentially adding new posts to it. So like when a client of mine posts a blog on their website, for example, I'll go post a little blurb on their Google My Business page that just says, you know, here's the new blog and here's what we're talking about and X, Y, and Z. And then when you have that, you'll get an email from Google, like, here's how many people saw your Google My Business listing. Here's how many people clicked on it. Here's how many people did X, Y, and Z. And so you can kind of even see the impact that a post may have. So one that I posted recently for a client got a bunch of traffic to their website from that post on their Google My Business, even though it's free for someone to click on it. So it's essentially free traffic. Of course, they're paying me, so there's that expense. But unlike with, let's say, Google Ads or Facebook Ads or one of these ad platforms, anything you get organically is free. You're not paying per click.
Right. And if I'm understanding correctly, what you're suggesting is the difference between like social media platforms and the Google My Business is that Google My Business should, in theory, be helping your SEO, where arguably Facebook has nothing to do with your SEO. It's really more just marketing and traffic. So to kind of consolidate what he just said for people listening, the advantage is not only is it sending you website traffic, it is also helping your overall website SEO, unlike social media. So get on Google My Business. I will have to look at that myself. All right. Number one. I love it. We started out with one I've never heard of.
Perfect. So number two, there's a million different ways I could go, but to keep it simple and something that any business owner should be able to do, I would say make sure that you get your foundation in check. So there's, for anyone that knows anything about SEO, there's on-page SEO, which is what you're doing to improve your SEO on your own website. And then there's off-page SEO, which is anything you're doing to get more signals from other websites to your website to improve your SEO. When it comes to on-page, I mean, the low-hanging fruit that I look for when I do an SEO audit for any business is, have you optimized the main pages you want people to find you for? So spending time on your privacy policy page isn't really going to matter when it comes to SEO. But spending time on your service pages and your product pages is. And depending on where your website is built, whether that be WordPress or Shopify or Squarespace, there are SEO tools, plugins, and features that, one, make it significantly easier for you to optimize your SEO, and two, really do make an impact. So getting one of those plugins, depending on what you're using, or just using the native feature on somewhere like Squarespace, and making sure that your title tags and descriptions and image tags are all relevant to the keywords you want to go after is mm-hmm. really important. And because you can use a plugin to do it, while it may not be as good as if you hired someone to do it, you can still do it yourself relatively affordably. All it's going to take is your time and a little bit of just thinking of, if you're making a title tag for a service page, what is that service? What is the keywords you want it to show for? And mm-hmm. that's pretty much it.
And the strategy, I mean, I'll just share what I use, and I am zero expert, but you know, question number one is, how do you know which keywords to go for? And again, for people listening and watching, keywords would be either a couple words or like a longer tail, which is more of like a phrase that is relevant to your site. So that can be said a million different ways. And the stuff that people Google, this is the other thing that I had to learn, is like, it might not make sense, literary sense. That was something I had to get over, is when creating, like, I wanted stuff to kind of roll off the tongue when people would read it. But the fact is, a lot of times what we Google is not necessarily how we would write an essay, for example. So you have to get creative when you search for keywords around your space. But I use Uber Suggest. I use the free ubersuggest.com version for a couple years. And then I finally paid when I got sick of being limited to 3 a day to find keywords. And then my blog has Yoast. I think they're both free. My on page is really good. My domain authority is, when the update came out, it dropped. So I'm curious to, SEO is on my next to-do list. But anyways, on page, you really can do well for with free stuff. I think it's the off page that's harder. Am I wrong about that? I think that's where you need more help.
Yeah, I would agree too. And when it comes to like on page, if you have a smaller business and you're not adding a lot of pages, it's one of those things where you can do it once and it's going to last you a while. Of course, mm-hmm. there's always more you can do, but like the base foundation is pretty good for a while. Yeah. But I would agree. Yeah, off page. And that's kind of number 3, is implementing some very basic off page strategies that anyone can do just to get some signals back to your site. And for those that don't know, when you're doing off page SEO, the goal is to essentially get your website listed on someone else's website that is hopefully more authoritative than yours. And so you had mentioned your, you know, domain authority is something you mentioned. Yeah. And that's essentially a rating that you have on your website. That's like, this is how much weight this website holds, if you will. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a Forbes.com, for example, their domain authority is well over 90 out of 100. And that's because almost everybody knows what Forbes.com is. Whereas smaller websites are probably 20 or less in domain authority. And so you're just trying mm-hmm. to get on these much larger websites, because if you think about it in the way that Google's looking at it, when Google crawls Forbes.com and it sees an article and there's a link in that article, a do follow link, so it's a very important thing, is you want a do follow link. They then follow that link to your website and they say, wow, if Forbes.com, this very authoritative mm-hmm. website, is basically giving you a shout out, mm-hmm. that means your website must be really good, because Forbes isn't shouting out many mm-hmm. scam websites or bad websites. And so you're basically trying to create these trust signals. And there's a lot of really easy ones. Forbes is not an easy one to get on, but you can use tools like, you know, different citation builders and things of that nature. I like a company called Bright Local, and they can get you on a lot of like directory websites. And while those are not as good as Forbes.com, there's mm-hmm. something that you can do relatively affordably. I think for like $90, you can get 30 of these directory submissions. And those backlinks do have value. And so they start you off with the main ones, like being on Facebook and Apple Maps and Yelp and some of those types of websites. Mm-hmm. And then they also have a laundry list of websites that are smaller, but still have some value to your SEO.
And this is called, say it again, it's called
Bright Local.
BrightLocal.com. So BRIGHT local.com. Another thing I would throw out there is, and let me ask this, am I correct in understanding that what Google especially likes is, for example, if Forbes.com, say an article is written about you and your website is put at the bottom, am I correct in saying that Google especially likes if your website then is linking to Forbes? It likes a complete circle, especially. So like somewhere in your website, then post, hey, I was featured in Forbes. Here's the link. Am I correct in saying that? That Google especially likes those complete cycles? Okay.
Absolutely. I do a lot of like press release style stuff for clients in that vein. And so, you know, you submit a press release, which might only be 400 words about this new thing you did. You hired someone new, you won an award, you launched a new product, and the press release then gets syndicated to a bunch of other websites. So a client, I recently got them on Yahoo Finance for a press release. And so now on the website, right below the fold, when you scroll down on the homepage, it says as seen on Yahoo Finance and a bunch of others. And so that's an easy way to do it, or write an entire blog about it on your website. Because obviously, if you're on Forbes or one of these other big websites, that's exciting. So share that. And then you can take that content and repurpose it to social media and all these other places as well.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of like for people who are in smaller areas and feeling like, oh my gosh, I would never be able to get onto Forbes or whatever. You know, another way to do that is just linking to other bloggers or other websites in your space, offer to write for another blog, and then make sure that kind of part of the deal is that they are then paying that in kind. Because from what I understand, simply linking to somebody else, if they're not going to link back to you, is not as beneficial. It's kind of that mutual, I link to you, you link to me. Podcasting is one. I try to do this. So like you'll get, my link is encouraging people to link on their own website. One, it's giving them more exposure, like let other people who already follow you hear more of your expertise. But then it's also linking back to my, because I'm trying to link to other reputable sites as well. I'm assuming that is helping my SEO strategy.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And that's a good point, is use your contacts to get some of those easy backlinks. If you have, you know, a friend who's a blogger, hit them up and say, hey, would you mind, you know, if I write a piece for you, or if you write a piece on me, and then link to my website, and then I'll reciprocate. And so that's a great way to get started, is just use your network to do that. And also use any local groups you're part of. Anything, if especially if you're smaller and you're local based, or even if you're smaller and your blogger is just starting out, you know, get out into the community and see what opportunities there are to get reciprocal links.
Another thing, depending on your niche, is finding businesses. So I'll give an example for me that helped me is I became a partner with Wayfair, and a lot of these bigger storefronts actually have blogs as well to try to help with their search engine optimization. And so Houzz is another one. There's a number of them like in the, you know, DIY home space. So I started writing for Wayfair's blog, and then they included, of course, my bio and a link to back to my website. That really helped my off page writing for magazines, like pitch articles to magazines. There's a lot of ways to get your website out there, I think. You just have to get a little creative. So you said Bright Local is one way to get more links. We've offered several other strategy ideas. So those are kind of overarching things that anybody should be doing for their business. If we would take a slightly deeper dive into a more technical, for those of us who are bloggers, those of us who are, like, for example, I think I'm up to like 700 pages on my website because I'm a blogger. So I have a lot of posts and pages on my blog. And questions I would have would be things like, if I have, a lot of bloggers do this, they have recurring posts like Meal Plan Monday, for example, or you have like a reoccurring post that happens once a week. When do you know to press like the no, don't show Google this? What's that called? No search. Why am I blanking? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, it's like a no index. That's what you're looking for.
Thank you. That's what it is. No index. When do you know to no index a post versus to index a post? How is that hurting, helping SEO? You know, if you're able to think of things, let's take a slightly deeper dive and tell me if you can think of three things that we should be doing on a more technical level.
Yeah.
I couldn't find the word. I need more coffee. This is water, people, not coffee. What?
Well, I would say, so to your point on the indexing, no indexing, I mean, no indexing to me is mostly useful for pages that, like, just think about like a page you may not want to show on Google. Which there's, for most people, there's very few pages you wouldn't want to show on Google. But I don't know, maybe you're So for example, like if you have a thank you page, let's say you have a form submission, it takes people to a thank you page. Probably no need for that to be indexed on Google. And if you're tracking that page as a conversion, so you know what's very common is you'll say, you know, the form submission on your website is a conversion. That's someone who's likely interested. Right. That's a lead. You want to track where that came from. So if all of your conversion tagging's on that page, you don't want people to find it unless they've gone through the process to get there, which would mean submitting your form.
Or else it's going to mess up
your... So those types of pages.
Right.
Yeah, or else it could throw off your conversion tracking. But terms in use likely isn't needed to be indexed, but I don't think there's much harm in that. So it's not something that is, especially for smaller websites and smaller companies, that I think is something you need to put too much thought into. But for stuff that you probably should put thought into, on every single post that you're making, I would say, you know, doing the keyword research, making sure all the tagging is right. And then one more technical piece, number one, that is really valuable is hooking up to what's called Google Search Console. And Google Search Console essentially puts your website into a Google program that then gives you a lot of feedback on how your website is being crawled by Google. It can also tell you, you know, what organic keywords you're getting traffic for and you're showing up for, so it's valuable in that way as well. And you can also submit a sitemap there, which is a technical piece of the website that's really, really useful to have. It's essentially giving Google a map of your website and its structure from, you know, homepage to subpages to the blog pages to all the different pieces on the site. And that sitemap helps Google's crawlers essentially visualize your site better and go through your site more effectively.
So if I was introduced to Google Search Console maybe 2 years ago now. I still don't understand it. But what am I getting out of Google Search Console? So like, I feel like a lot of the things are also on Uber Suggest. Is that true? Or am I confusing the two? Like, I think a lot, I think I can find what I'm ranking for in Uber Suggest and some of the things that you said, but what should I be looking for on Google Search Console? What will it give me that I can then change what my practice is?
Yeah, I think the biggest benefit that would help you change things is it will alert you to things that it's found when crawling the site that may affect the coverage or usability of your site. Mm-hmm. So I'll get emails for, you know, clients who I'm working on, and it'll say, you know, this page, the text is too small on mobile, or the image is too small on mobile. And those types of things do affect the performance of your website and your SEO, because once again, you got to think of it in the way that Google is trying to show the best possible resource for whatever someone has searched. And so if they go to your site and this would be number two is page speed, but if they go to your site and it loads poorly, or the text is hard to read, or the image is broken, those types of things are things you want to know. And when you get up to 700 pages, it's highly unlikely that you're going to every page on a regular basis. So you're not going to find that.
I literally just saw a blog post yesterday that I was like, oh my word, I forgot I even wrote that blog post. Yeah, about that one. So yes, absolutely. Yeah. Also a side note, this is really fascinating. I learned that there's a direct correlation between usability and font size. This was a little bit ago, but that was really fascinating. So if I understood it, and I'm blanking, tell me if I'm wrong, because I can't remember. But the recommendation is it should be no less than 18. Is that right?
I don't know the exact number, but that does sound correct. You want it to look good on mobile and on desktop.
Yeah, and that it's pretty obvious statement. If it's too small to read, people are not going to hang out long enough to or squint. So anyway, I'm pretty sure 18 is what's in my head, but it was a really interesting article. That was a little bit ago. And it did actually, it made it look a lot nicer. It was just slightly bigger. So maybe go change your font size to 18, the minimum font, like the paragraph, not like the headings and stuff like that for everyone listening, like your paragraph-based font size. So you said that. And then number two, page speed.
Yeah, that goes back to the same thing. If you send someone to your website, people expect it to load up fast. When you open an app and you get the spinning wheel for a few seconds, you get frustrated, you close the app. When you open a page, same thing. You open it, you get the spinning wheel, you wait, and at some point you give up on it. And so not only is it affecting your SEO, it could be affecting your lead gen. It could be affecting whatever your conversion is on your website, because people give up quickly when there's, you know, 50 other options. And that's the thing. When you're on Google, there are 50 other options minimum for what you're looking for.
Yeah.
So you can use Google's free tool once again. It's Google Page Speed Insights is what it's called. And that tool is really useful because what it does is when you put your website through it, it loads up how fast you are on desktop and on mobile. And then it'll give you why it took so long to load. So in
and that
cases,
was Google
Page Speed Insights.
Page Speed Insights. Okay. My site speed, this has been a huge issue for me. It, like, I did so many DIY. So like what you said to your point is I would go to these pages and then I would go through and try to DIY it myself. And then half the time they're using language and I'm like, what does this even mean? And then I have to Google what Google's telling me to do because I have no idea what the words even mean. I mean, that's basically how I created a blog. So you can figure it out. You can DIY some of your way into site speed. Is site speed something that you do?
Yeah, it absolutely is.
And because this is like a number one for people. I mean, yeah. SEO is really important, but like site speed is stuff that a lot of us are just like, can you do this for me? What do you charge? Do it.
Yeah. And one of the reasons it's probably so hard is that there's so many different factors. So in some cases, I had a client recently, and the reason that their homepage was a little bit slow is that, you know, they're an interior design firm, so the images are extremely high quality. And so something that I was able to do to shave off a few seconds was take all the images off of the homepage, put them through Photoshop, use Photoshop to shrink the file size, compress the file size without losing the quality, and then re-upload them to the site. So to the naked eye, it's the same image of the same quality, but the size of the file is much smaller, so it loads much faster. And so that was a way to shave a few seconds. In some cases, you need a developer, and I am in no way a developer in the sense of like I can sit there and write lines of code for hours and put something out with that. And so sometimes I'll have to rely on a developer, and that's a whole nother project. But in many cases, you can save with small things like the images. And there are
and
a few plugins
to optimize.
There are a few plugins. Yeah. I know Shopify has a good one. I know WordPress has a good one to quickly optimize some of that stuff. And in that case, you just want to make sure you go through the site and make sure it didn't break anything. That was a huge issue for a client who came to me. He's like, hey, I used this thing on Shopify to speed up my site. And what it ended up doing was breaking hundreds of pages. And so I had to revert everything. Fortunately, they had a revert button.
Yeah.
So you just want to make sure you're auditing everything you do.
I have been there. And this is where, so I finally did hire somebody then for my site speed. But I, as somebody who it literally DIY is my shtick, and I have also DIY'd most of my website myself as well. But this is an area truly and honestly, this is worth paying for. I wish somebody had just like told me that I trusted, you know, 3 years ago, like, pay somebody to set up your website, pay somebody to set it up right and teach you just the basics from the get-go on how to optimize it, because you end up spending so much of your time. So if you're concerned about page speed, you can try to DIY it. Don't break your site. And if you do, call Jake because you'll be panicking and you will need a resource. So make sure you keep Jake's number handy here. So we said, so two is page speed. Mm-hmm. Number one on the deeper dive was
Google Search Console.
And then number two is page speed. And we've given you the website for the page speed DIY. That was Google Page Speed.
Yeah. Page speed, I think, is one word. Don't know why. Page speed Insights.
Okay. And then number three.
Yeah. Number three, if you're deep diving. Yeah, if you're deep diving, and this one is more expensive whether you hire someone or not, because what you would want to do is take your website and put it through a service like SEMrush or Ahrefs or one of the other services like that. Those are my two favorites, because what those services do, and I think they all have free trials, but then they end up being, you know, hundreds of dollars per month if you keep them. But what those do is they crawl your website like Google would and spit back and they spit back a ton of information that you may or may not, probably won't know what to do with. Mm-hmm. But it comes back and it tells you things as simple as, hey, your title tag is too long, or your meta description is too long. And then it also spits out technical things like your robot's TXT isn't working properly, you know? And so it spits back, I think it's almost a 200-point checklist.
Because I know exactly what that means, robot TXT. I have no
exactly.
idea.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's going to spit back a ton of stuff that you may not know what to do with. Yeah. But it's a, you know, almost 200-point checklist of SEO-related things that your website needs to be optimized for. And that's a huge, huge benefit if you really want to deep dive into getting on the mm-hmm. technical side of your website's SEO. And those tools also show you your backlinks and the keywords you rank for. So it's even better than, let's say, Uber suggests in that case, because it's showing you the all of the metrics for the keywords that you rank for, where you are on the page on average, when they found that mm-hmm. keyword, if it's more, they can even tell you if the keyword itself is more informational or more of like a buying keyword, you know, if it's intent-based or informational-based. Mm-hmm. They'll know if you, so when you Google something, you'll see like people also ask. There is a way to get shown there. It'll tell you if you're there. And it'll tell you if you're in the map pack or not. So this is a more advanced tool that gives you information overload.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to go deeper, that's where I would go with it. And, yeah. you know, you have a couple options. That's something I offer actually is just the audit itself, where I have mm-hmm. those paid tools. So I'll run your website through it and then give you the analysis on top of it to tell you, here's what was found through this mm-hmm. audit process. And here's, you know, some of the things I would focus on if you want to do anything about it. So that's really helpful. Or, you know, go spend $500 a month to have it on hand at all times and
to not know what it's even telling you to do anyways.
Exactly.
That makes no sense to me. Hire Jake. And then with SEO, are you, so like, I think sometimes I get a little confused between SEO and domain authority, but I understand if I'm correct that SEO is ultimately helping your domain authority. They're not the same, because that confuses me a little bit.
Domain authority is just like a rating. It's essentially, if you think of it, it's just like a rating from 1 to 100 on how strong your domain is from an authoritative standpoint. The bigger, more well-known your website is, likely the higher domain authority it'll have.
Right. So domain authority is more so other people linking back to
it. It's kind of a piece. I would say it's a piece of SEO, and it actually isn't something that we generally focus on.
Yeah.
Because if I'm correct, and this may have changed, but to the best of my knowledge, last I knew, domain authority is something that isn't really necessarily even given by Google. I think it's given by Moz, which is another SEO tool that you can use, similar like an SEMrush or Ahrefs. Yeah. And so it's good to note. And if you see it right, like if you're going to hire someone for SEO, it's one of the things you probably want to see rise over time.
Right. Right.
However, it's not necessarily your number one.
Right. The SEO, basically, if you improve your SEO, your domain authority is probably going to go up. Well, Jake, thank you. So many questions. The bottom line, your digital marketing firm, it does a lot more than just help people with SEO. This is, I think, one that is more generally needed for the majority of us to start out with. So Watson Digital, and people can find you at jacobdazio.com.
Yeah. And I'm changing that over to jakefrommarketing.com to make it easier to find. So jakefrommarketing.com/SEO, or if you go to the homepage, it's in the menu. Go there. That's how you do the SEO audit, if you'd like me to audit your website and give you analysis.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. I pray God's blessing over your home and all of your adventures, your digital marketing firm. And thank you. I learned a lot. There's things I will go do myself.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. Thank you so much for your time.
Yep. Absolutely. Thanks, Jake.
All right. I'll talk to you. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Imperfectly Empowered Podcast. I would love to hear your thoughts from today. Head to your preferred podcasting platform and give the show an honest review and let me know what you think. Remember, you cannot be redefined, only redeveloped one imperfect day at a time. Your story matters, and you are loved.